Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Dr. Sean Scott, a visiting assistant professor of American Studies at Christopher Newport University, a specialist on religion during the Civil War era, and previously an assistant editor of the Papers of Abraham Lincoln Project. Sean earned his PhD in history from Purdue University, go Boilermakers, and is author of the recent book, A Visitation of God, Northern Civilians Interpret the Civil War, published by Oxford University Press. We will link to that book and some information about Sean on our website. And also don't forget, we are free on iTunes. We have a Facebook fan page that tells you about upcoming episodes. And we're also on Twitter. So please join us at all those different outlets because we appreciate the company. Sean, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me, Tony. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we are coming up on the sesquicentennial of the end of the U.S. Civil War here in just a few months. I think April of 2015, if I'm correct. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And it's the sesquicentennial, and that's such an odd word. I had to actually practice saying that for about 10 minutes before I gave you a call here.
It's a good $10 word you can impress your students with.
I know, it is. But why do we celebrate sesquicentennials? That's like 150 years.
Yeah. Well, I'm not really sure when that term was originated, but I think any excuse to celebrate the Civil War, to learn from it, to study it, is a good reason. So especially if you can impress people with fancy words like that, why not?
That's true. You're a historian, so you're going to say that. You've got to celebrate history. You guys are going to come up with a sesquicentennial plus three celebration to celebrate the 153rd anniversary of something.
There's
I know.
Always an interest in the Civil War.
There is, and we're going to talk about that today because you have written a very interesting book about how common folk Americans in what is known as the Old Northwest, and we'll talk about what that means here in a second, because I guess I'm in the New Northwest, how these common folk conceived of the war through a religious lens. But before we even get to that, I'm fascinated what you have done in a previous career or a previous occupation. You worked with this Abraham Lincoln Papers Project. What I mean, when people think about the Civil War, we always think Abraham Lincoln. So what did you do with that project?
Yes, the Lincoln Project is an effort to collect everything ever written by or to Abraham Lincoln. And it began with the Lincoln Legal Papers, and that was finished up in the late 90s. And then there were folks in Springfield who were working at finding and annotating all of his papers prior to the presidency. And my assignment was to work at the National Archives and to comb through all of the documents and letters that the Archives has collected from the national government. So in particular, I worked at letters of the War Department, Postmaster General. There's all kinds of just unique files and papers to look at, and we looked for letters by Lincoln and to Lincoln. And I was fortunate to be able to find a few new Lincoln documents, and these were documents that were in his hand, in his own writing, that were not incorporated in the volumes put together by Basler in the 1950s and 60s.
Did you find the original 150,000-word version of the Gettysburg Address that he accidentally forgot at the Motel 6 down there in Frederick, Maryland on his way up? Because I hear that exists. That's on the internet.
Motel 6? Oh, well, I wish we'd have known that. We were looking at the Econo Lodge, so no wonder we didn't find it.
Yeah, you got to trust the internet on that.
I have to go back there and find that, because that would be that's a big find that they're still.
Yeah, that would be something that he had this big long speech and he says, "Oh, I forgot it. I better write something, you know, quickly on a napkin here on the train."
Exactly.
But what you mentioned that you found some original documents. Are these, you know, really major document finds or?
These were. I mean, they were telegrams.
Okay.
And so one of them had to do with a regiment of troops, and then just, nothing that is going to revolutionize Lincoln studies or the Civil War. But it's still a neat, because the National Archives, you know, they don't have inventories of everything in these boxes, and so they didn't even, you know, realize that these documents in Lincoln's hand are sitting there. And so it's nice for us to be able to find them, and then scholars can have access to them in the future.
Is it kind of neat making that find? I mean, what's the moment that you realize, oh, I found something that's been missing for 155 or 160 years, and it's sitting here, and this was something that Lincoln had in his hands. Does it give you a little shudder up your spine?
It's definitely cool. And two, there's a kind of a competition among all of the researchers with the Lincoln papers. They have a Lincoln Corps of Discovery. And so it's a big deal to find an original autograph in Lincoln's hand, and then you get awarded a big magnifying glass, you know, because we've combed through all these papers and we found a new Lincoln document. So it's a pretty neat thing.
So you have a big magnifying glass up in your office on a plaque or something?
No, it's actually one that's usable. So,
oh.
For instance, if you were to print off an old newspaper from the 19th century and it's really small, and you can use a magnifying glass to be able to read it better. So it's actually a usable object.
Yeah. And the last question I have on this, too, and when I was out at Christopher Newport University, you had the opportunity to tell me about this, and I just want to share this with our listeners because I'm fascinated by the work that historians do. You said you're searching for the lost documents of Abraham Lincoln, and you worked at the War Department or the National Archives and look through the documents of the War Department. Are these things sitting in a big box that somebody left next to the mop in the janitor's closet? I mean, how do these things get lost and how do you find them?
Well, I mean, this is a bigger project than what was done in the 1950s because in addition to looking for those documents in Lincoln's hand, we're also collecting all of the documents to Lincoln. So any average citizen or congressman, whoever, wrote to Lincoln and asked, can you give a position for my son, or can you help me because I need some money because we're struggling financially? I mean, you would be amazed at all of the people who just felt like they could personally direct a letter to the president and he would read it and hopefully do something for them. And so that was one of the really cool things. And so, yeah, these documents are kept in boxes in storage someplace, and we would put in a call slip and then it would be brought to us and have it on a cart and be on our table, and we'd just pull out documents and go through and see which ones were to or by Lincoln.
I'm betting that in 150 years, there's going to be some historians that find all those lost emails from the IRS and EPA or something. But I guess we'll have to wait.
Let's hope so.
Yeah. Anyways, Abe Lincoln is a very cool topic. He's a pretty major historical figure who we often think about when we talk about the Civil War. But there are other things called mundane topics from common folks, and that's the thing that you are dealing with. And I personally actually find this to be incredibly fascinating because we don't focus on the folks who might be a store owner or a housewife that writes a letter to somebody on the front, but that tells us a lot about what is going on at this time. Tell me how you came to focus your scholarly studies on looking at these letters from what is known as the Old Northwest.
Sure. The war obviously was fought by just average civilians. You know, if people didn't volunteer, there would have been no armies to keep the Union together. And I had read a book by Stephen Woodworth, who teaches at Texas Christian, called While God is Marching On, The Religious World of Civil War Soldiers. And he looks at the faith of soldiers. And so I got to thinking, well, if obviously these soldiers were fighting and viewed the war through a lens of faith, there must be something on the home front as well. So I just simply started looking for letters to civilians, went to the Indiana Historical Society, and just said, hey, can you pull out some letters, letter collections of civilians? And started looking, and obviously there were a lot that didn't have any religious content, but I quickly found that a lot of civilians were using their faith to understand why the war was being fought. And so that was how I got the idea and how the project started.
Now, have you been a Civil War buff ever since you were a kid, or was this one of these projects that, well, I need a dissertation topic, and somebody opened our archive doors, and there it was?
Yeah, not really. I've always been interested in history. It's funny, I was, when we moved, my wife and I, when we moved, I think, to Arkansas for my first job, I was going through some of the stuff I'd collected, and I actually wrote a paper in junior high about the politicization of religion in Indiana in the 1850s and 1860s, and that is one of the themes of the book, and I had no recollection of ever writing that paper. So maybe I was meant to be done, you know, at a younger age, but I liked American history, and I was interested in the 18th century and the 19th century, and ultimately when I went to Purdue, they had some very strong 19th century historians who I studied with, and I just kind of picked the Civil War from there.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of fortuna, I think, in the way we end up picking our topics, and you probably had that idea rattling around in the back of your brain from junior high and just waiting to come out, and that's probably why you ended up at Purdue as well. I don't know. I mean, some hand of God is moving you in that direction.
Yeah, the remarkable providences on an individual perspective. That's what the civilians in the Civil War were looking at.
Yeah, and it is, you know, reading through your book and reading through some of the passages and letters that you cite, you do pick that up quite a bit. And again, like I said, I love talking about how common people actually viewed this. When you did this study, you're looking at common folk, and I'm using that term very broadly. Who are we actually talking about? Are these housewives? Are they shopkeepers? What is the range of folks?
Yeah, well, since I'm looking at the Old Northwest, which I'll kind of just explain, you know, why I chose that topic, and then maybe answer the next question.
Actually, explain what the Old Northwest is, because I'm out here in the Northwest.
Right.
And we don't call it the New
Under the Articles of Confederation, the government created the Northwest Territory to deal with the problem of how to take territories claimed by Virginia and other states and make new states come in on the same footing as the original 13. And so out of the Northwest Territory, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Illinois, and Wisconsin were formed. And so this is a group that an area of the country that I looked at in the 1860s as being the most representative. So a lot of studies have been done on New England, of course, and the influence of the Puritans and religion there. New York, Pennsylvania have gotten a lot of research done on them as well. And so I looked at the Old Northwest and said, okay, this has a mix of New Englanders and Pennsylvanians who migrated there in the 1820s or 1830s. It's got Southerners who came in the early 1800s and beyond. And it's got people who were born there. You know, these states were admitted in the 18-teens and 20s. And so it's got basically a mix of all of what the United States was at that time. And so I felt this is an understudied area and just contains kind of the melting pot idea. And so I thought it would be good to focus on that area. And then practically, since I was at Purdue, it made it easier for me to do my research runs and to hit two or three archives at a time and not break the bank and, you know, having to research all over the country.
Yeah, so the Old Northwest is largely the Great Lake states, and then you also throw in Iowa.
Yeah, I threw in Iowa and Minnesota because these were states that were part of the Union by this time.
Okay.
And I didn't want to leave them out, so I have a few voices from there as well. But back to your question about who these people were. So these are not, you know, famous people. There are a few people that, you know, I talked about the Bishop of Ohio, and there's a prominent banker in Indianapolis named Calvin Fletcher who's got a huge number of diaries that have been published. And so some of these might be known by some historians, but by and large, these are average individuals who are not going to be in any history book. They've never done anything, you know, famous per se. So we're talking a lot of farmers because of the area that I was looking at, and a lot of housewives. So just kind of the average individuals who would have been lost to history if social historians didn't care about what the average individual thought and felt, you know, throughout their life.
Now, what is the literacy rate around this time? Because that's going to have an impact on who you're looking at.
Extremely high. Scholars like James McPherson have noted how the Civil War soldiers were probably the most literate army in the history of warfare up to this time. And the same thing goes for civilians. So, you know, everyone, you know, at this time in particular would typically learn to read by reading the Bible. You know, most people had only a handful of books. And so there's this religious language that they are used to just from a child. Even if they didn't attend church all that regularly, they understand, you know, who important figures in the Bible were. And so they could read and write, had the familiarity with the scripture. Now, spelling and things like that would be, you know, very much up to the individual. So a lot of times you would find some very unique spelling and some very bad grammar, but you can always figure out what the person's trying to say.
You must be good at grading undergraduate papers then. because I mean,
it definitely helps.
Yeah, things have not changed over 150 years, and I still get bad grammar. One of the things that you mentioned is how everybody capitalized nouns, or a lot of people capitalize every single noun in their writing. And I see that with undergraduate students now. So I think we're going back to the days of old again. I don't know.
But at least they weren't texting in their letters or using those abbreviations like sometimes you might just sneak into an essay.
Yeah. No. Yeah, I hear you on that. Where did you find these documents? Did you have to go to different houses and look through attics and open up boxes? Or did these things get archived? You mentioned you visited a number of archives. How do these things end up getting archived?
I think in most cases, these are letters that have been in families for many years. And at some point in time, the families realize that these have a lot of historical value and they're donated to specific state archives or historical societies. And so I get them that way. I know some of these state archives, they have budgets to purchase some of these as well. But a lot of them were just donated. And so I was able to go to most of the state archives in the area, university archives that had letter collections as well. I don't remember off the top of my head how many places I went, but it was something like 30-some different archives that I visited. So I made the rounds throughout the Great Lakes region.
So are families collecting these things in old wooden cigar boxes, and then somebody in the 1930s goes over to a local university and says, here, I have these. You might want them. I've been cleaning out my attic. Because for me, that's fascinating, because I know that many of our faculty, when they retire, they donate their library. And I always wonder, well, what does that mean? And so, we're turning over our papers and notes and stuff. And I sit there and go, I've thrown most of mine away or burned them. So I guess I should be collecting this stuff. But how does this stuff, I mean, do people turn them in?
Well, what's most interesting, I think, is you got to understand that these are letters by civilians on the home front written to soldiers. So in the first place, the soldiers had to actually be able to preserve these letters.
Yeah.
So they're keeping them in their knapsacks, they're fighting battles, and somehow miraculously, I mean, they are having these letters preserved, and then obviously that's going to mean a lot to the family, you know, especially, you know, whether or not they died, but whatever the case, it gives the experiences of the soldiers and then the letters to their loved ones at home. So these mean a lot. There's a lot of value. So it's understandable that these lasted, and whether they were donated in the 1930s or, you know, as recently as the 1980s or 90s, these had a lot of meaning. So I think in many cases, the families realize that, you know, as time passes and they don't know these individuals, there are scholars who could find a lot of value in them, and so I think that's why they donate them.
Now, we mentioned a bunch of private letters. Are there any other writings that also fall into these archives, op-ed pieces or sermons or anything?
Yeah, in addition to the letters, I looked at diaries, some published and some original manuscripts. I looked at church records because I wanted to see how the war impacted the churches, and so I'd look at church minutes and see if they passed resolutions or in their meetings they talked about the war or soldiers who'd gone away. I looked at the newspapers, both the secular press, which had a lot of editorials and comments on religious subjects at the time, and then also the religious press, I covered about all the source bases that I could think of for this time period.
And I want to go back to the letters, because that is the thing that really fascinates me, because these are people's private thoughts. And you discuss this early on in the book, and this must be something that historians think about. When you're reading these private letters, and some of them say, you know, dear Sam, you know, this is meant for your eyes only, and, you know, this is a private correspondence, but, you know, yet it makes it into the cigar box, which then makes it into the university archive. You're reading that, and it says, you know, for your eyes only. Do you feel somehow as if you're violating a privacy agreement or something like that?
Well, it does give you pause, but then quickly that evaporates, because you want to know, you know, what was so interesting that in most cases it's nothing that personal that, you know, they're trying to hide to other people, but just the idea that, you know, there's something very personal in writing to a loved one, a spouse, a son, or a brother, and just wanting to make sure that you care and that, you know, only don't be reading this, you know, personal letter about what's going on in our life to your buddies in the tent.
Yeah.
And so I think at the time, that had a lot more meaning than, say, now, when these people have been dead for, you know, a century and more. And so there's, you know, this passage of time that I think makes it not so, makes you not have any qualms, really, for reading their private correspondence.
Did you have to get clearance from an Eternal Review Board, or sometimes known as the Human Subjects Division, to do this stuff?
No, live individuals involved here, and none of these were, like, classified documents or anything like that.
So okay.
There was nothing special that needed to be done. They're all available to anybody in the public who would want to go and look at these archives. They could look at these letters.
In the process of doing this, and I asked this a little bit before when you were dealing with the Lincoln Project, does it affect you when you're reading these things? I mean, you hold this in your hand, or you're looking at it through glass if they're trying to preserve the integrity of the actual paper, but you're doing this, and does it give you a shudder up and down your spine? It's like it just transports you back 150 years and almost gives you an out-of-body experience?
Well, sometimes it can definitely be moving, especially if you know the end of the story. So, say, for instance, a soldier is about to be killed, and this is the last letter from home he ever gets.
Wow.
And you can kind of empathize, you know, with that loved one who is missing them and knowing that they're never going to meet on Earth, or the, you know, the same way if it's a soldier's last letter that he writes home. So there's definitely a lot of pathos in some of these letters that personalize his history. These aren't just, you know, people who lived long ago. They were real flesh and blood human beings, and they had some of the same cares and concerns that we have today. And so you can really empathize with a lot of their situations as best as you can from, you know, sitting at a in an air-conditioned building looking at their letters, you know, 150 years after the time they were written.
Yeah, I get that sense of reading through a number of these in your book. And again, it gives me shudders just to be reading it through what you put in your book. But, I can imagine just seeing the original document and, you know, wow. I mean, this is a very cool job that you have.
It's fun. It really is.
So let's talk about what you found here in your book, A Visitation of God. How's the feel of this walk through the four-year course of the Civil War? You start with a chapter on the looming crisis, and then you end with an examination of how people reacted to Lincoln's assassination. So we have some bookends here. But you also have a topical edge to it. You separate the chapters into some common themes that emerge in your looking at these documents. So let's go ahead and take that as a guide. We'll kind of start with the war on the horizon, and we'll end with Lincoln's death, and in the process we'll talk through some of these themes here. So take us back to 1860. Abraham Lincoln was just elected president. Buchanan is a lame duck. He's on his way out. What are you seeing in the letters? What's the mood, specifically religious mood, at the time in the old Northwest?
Well, there's definitely uncertainty. You know, Lincoln was a sectional candidate, only got 40% of the popular vote. And even in the North, some people who weren't too sure that he was presidential timber didn't know what to think. But among religious people, there's this sense that, you know, providence, God is controlling the events of history. And so there is a purpose in why Lincoln was elected and why South Carolina has seceded. And although they're uncertain as to what the future is, there is this kind of faith that God has the best intentions of the nations at hand, because many people believe that America is this, you know, kind of sacred nation. God's, you know, we Americans are the new Israel, God's chosen people to promote Christianity and freedom around the world. And so if it's necessary potentially for this division of the country that is looming, you know, there must be a reason. And so some people are trying to figure out, well, is this a judgment for sins? What's going on here? But there is this underlying faith that providence is what controls history. And so you see that in their letters, in the secession crisis, as it's known, the winter of 1860-1861. And then by the time, you know, the other states of the South have seceded and Fort Sumter is attacked and the war starts, then you've got this almost gung-ho spirit, because, you know, Lincoln calls for 75,000 troops. And everybody thinks, oh, this is going to be an easy war. It's going to be over, you know, in a battle or two. And, you know, all these young men who have heard about their fathers who fought in the Mexican-American War and earned valor there, now is their chance to go out and prove their manhood. And you still got this emphasis on, okay, God is chastening the country, purging it of certain sins, and this is going to be over pretty fast. So let's all go out there and have our opportunity for laurels and for glory, because this is all part of what God is trying to do through our country.
There are definitely two different ways one could take the providential message of God's hand in American history here. One is that it's a purging of our sins, that we have this blight of slavery, and we have probably a bevy of other sins that we have to reconcile. And so I guess fighting this war would be our punishment for all those past sins. But on the other hand, one could say, well, this is part of God's will to move us along and to reveal his greater glory, et cetera, et cetera. Was there a certain tip in the balance of that, or was it evenly mixed?
Well, I would say that most people believed in providence, but then not all were sure what exactly was going on, especially at first, when you got to consider the Old Northwest. A lot of these people are very conservative racially. So states like Indiana and Illinois, when they revised their constitutions in the 1850s, they technically outlawed African Americans from settling in the state. It wasn't easily enforced, but there was a lot of anti-black sentiment in these areas, and so a lot of people would look at, okay, this is a war for the Union, but this has nothing to do with slavery. Slavery could be, biblically sanctioned by looking at Old Testament passages. So there's a mixed bag as far as what these sins are. A lot of people just say in general, well, we have problems with profanity and drunkenness and, all the typical sins that might be condemned specifically in Scripture. But then others would say, slavery is there. So it really depended on their political persuasion and their views related to race at the time period as to what they thought. But then once the fighting starts and there's first Bull Run, which was fought on a Sunday, then there's this outcry, well, why did we lose in the North? Well, because we were violating the Sabbath and fighting on the Lord's Day, and as long as we have these profane politicians and generals who are leading troops into battle on Sunday when they should be worshiping the Lord, then we're not going to be blessed, and so we have all these sins that we need to repent of if we're going to expect victory. So Bull Run, getting the Northerners getting their nose bloodied there was a real eye-opener. And it really, I think, made some people not necessarily give up on the idea of providence, but at least give up on the idea of a short and easy victory.
And shortly into the war, Lincoln decides to pull the trigger and declare emancipation. This is interesting. I hadn't known about the way that the Constitution in Indiana was written, very anti-black and preventing African-American settlement there. How was that taken?
Well, it definitely divided the North. In the early 1861, there's a lot of support for the war. Even the war Democrats, regardless of party, a lot of people are in favor of keeping the Union together. But as the war progresses and there are these signs that it's becoming an emancipation war, you have a really mixed bag. You have a lot of Democrats making opposition. You even have some Republicans who might be anti-slavery, but they definitely don't want to be, fighting and dying to free slaves. And in some cases, I uncovered, families that were even divided. So there was one prominent case of a guy who was an officer, Illinois soldier, and his would become his wife, his fiance at the time, and she was very anti-slavery, even bordering on abolitionist, and she was saying all these things in her letters, and he wrote back very bluntly, "I'm not fighting to free the slaves. I'm fighting here to preserve the Union, and I wish you would stop talking about this." And in their case, ultimately, they were able to patch over these differences, and they did get married later in 1863. But it could be something that would even divide families.
And how did they phrase things religiously that in that respect? Because sometimes you get to religious absolutes, and slavery is a sin. No, slavery is sanctioned. How did it, specifically in that case, was there a lot of religious language used to justify each of the positions, or possibly to use religion to reconcile these two parties?
Definitely. There have been several studies done on, pro-slavery religion as defended in the Bible, and especially, Southern ministers, and Northerners were aware of these arguments. But on the other hand, a lot of people would just focus on the Exodus, and they would say, God didn't want his people to be slaves in Egypt, and he worked miraculously through Moses and the plagues to free the children of Israel from Egyptian bondage, and the same deal that, African Americans have been in bondage, and now this is God working through this war to free them. And so they would look at these religious passages and try to find parallels with the current situation.
And that one couple that you mentioned, did they have a dueling biblical passages when they were writing back and forth?
They didn't necessarily quote, you know, scripture and verse.
Okay.
But, you know, they would, you know, give these general ideas that, you know, slavery is immoral and wrong, and it goes against, you know, God's will for individuals to have freedom. And so they usually didn't, again, start splitting theological hairs, but there would be a religious undertone into what they would be writing to each other.
One of the things that I just heard you mention was the word ministers, that ministers were getting involved in this thing. And at the outset of the war, so, you know, war is looming. It looks like it's coming in the late 1860. It finally breaks out in 1861. Ministers start, I can imagine, some of them are starting to preach from the pulpit. And you had just mentioned that there are some Democrats in these old Northwest territories. We normally associate the Democrats at the time being in the South. But as you say, it's a mixed group of folks up there. Did this have an impact on how churches operated? I mean, I can imagine there's going to be a lot of conflict.
Definitely there was, and that's one of the themes of the book, how religion was politicized, and it divided churches in some cases. So especially as you move further into 1862 and 1863, they are known, the anti-war folks in the North are known as copperheads. They're poisonous snakes that are, you know, trying to undermine the body politic. And so you've got these churches where the ministers in many cases were staunchly unionist, and maybe they didn't preach about the war or focus on the war every single Sunday, but when there were, you know, fast days or Thanksgiving days or special days, they would mention the war and what they thought God was doing in it. And it would alienate many of these Democratic members. And even if they would just pray and they'd say, please use the word end slavery or something like that, and that, you know, had a political connotation. There are examples that I found of, in the middle of prayers, people walking out because they were offended, and some people would rejoice in that, and they'd say, okay, this guy who's, you know, just kind of a quasi-believer because he's a copperhead and a Democrat and he's probably not really a Christian, we're purging the church of these riffraff and we're making it a purer church. And in some cases, there were, by 1864, enough of these Democrats that were fed up that they started what's known as the New Church Movement, and they created their own churches, which ostensibly were to be nonpartisan. But in reality, these were places where they just wouldn't have to hear about the war, they wouldn't have to hear about slavery, and so they were kind of democratic churches, and these started up in Illinois and in Ohio. So there was a real division, and many ministers, they didn't care about this because, again, they felt like God was on the side of the Union in the war, and so they wanted to purge these democratic members. But there were a few who realized that maybe Christianity is getting a bad name by becoming politicized, and maybe we should be focusing on getting people prepared for the next world and salvation, as opposed to being so concerned about politics and how things are going in this world.
Do these divides, are they still reflected down to this day in denominational differences?
Not so much in denominational differences. In the post-war period, you know, Southern Presbyterians and Northern Presbyterians unified, and et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, the Southern Baptists are still divided from the Northern Baptists, but that's more over theology and issues like that rather than, you know, issues relating to the war. But you could definitely see, in one case, I found, looking at church records, one of the moderators, you know, so again, these are rural churches where they didn't necessarily have a regular pastor salaried to preach every Sunday, and so there would be something of a circuit, and they might only have service once a month because this pastor would be traveling to other churches. Well, this one moderator was a Democrat, and there were some resolutions that were pro-union that kind of divided the church, and he basically left the church, and it looked to me from the church records that for almost a decade, they didn't have a regular minister, that the war so divided the church that it more or less divided the congregation to the point that the minister was forced out, and then by the mid-1870s, there was an attempt at reconciliation, and this guy came back. So it did have a lasting impact on some of these churches.
Imagine how that would all sort out. There's another dimension that things could sort out as well, and this is how one views the actual fighting. I know that within Christianity, there tends to be a strong pacifist flavor to many denominations, the Quakers being the obvious case, but you have the Mennonites, and the Mennonites were around in this area at the time. But on the other hand, there's other folks that say, hey, let's pick up the sword to fight for the glory of God. Did you see any of that rhetoric reflected or that division reflected?
Yeah, there were a strong flavor of Quakers and Mennonites, especially in Indiana and Ohio. And they were divided. There are instances of, Quakers getting drafted and what are they going to do? They either have to pay a commutation, $300 is what the government decided on. They have to furnish a substitute. In some cases, communities would put together money so conscientious objectors and others wouldn't have to fight and they could hire substitutes. In some cases, though, they complied and they would go to the camp. And I remember a couple Quakers in Ohio, they said, well, we went to camp, but we didn't have to drill, so it was okay. They didn't actually have to handle their rifles and take target practice or whatever the soldiers were doing. And other examples of Quakers who did serve, some volunteered, and they were excommunicated because the church, it violated the church's pacifist teachings. There are other examples, though, where these Quaker soldiers volunteered and the church just felt like, well, it was an exigency that was necessary, and they kind of brushed under the rug their teachings, and they didn't excommunicate these people. So it all depended on the community, the individual involved. But there was definitely a lot of pacifist sentiment. And even with the ministers in the Protestant denominations, there was a division over whether or not ministers should get involved. Some people would say, well, it's okay if ministers go off and serve as chaplains because they're basically just preaching to the soldiers, doing the same thing. And others would say, ministers who go off to fight, they're neglecting the most important thing and preaching to their flocks at home. But then others would counter and say, if, a soldier or an average civilian could go out and serve as a soldier, ministers should be leaders and take the example, and they can still serve the country while having conversations, not as a chaplain would officially, but they can still be witnessing and giving the gospel to others. And so there was a real division even among the clergy over what was acceptable for them.
Did you see this reflected in some of the letters that passed back and forth between the front and then the home front? Are there people really wrestling and struggling with their faith, saying, yeah, I know that we have to abolish this sin. Oh, this might be God's will that we're doing this, but boy, I don't want to be fighting or killing my brethren. And do you see those struggles within people's own minds?
There are some in the letters. More of those tend to come out in the newspapers because, there would be these ministers or civilians who would write in, and this way they could have a broader audience and they could kind of pull other people within the denomination. So, say, the Western Christian Advocate was a Methodist paper published in Cincinnati, which had a wide circulation throughout this region. And so, someone might write in and say, well, I think it's okay if soldiers or if ministers go and fight as soldiers, but what about killing? Doesn't that violate, the Ten Commandments? And then they would hope for someone else to write in or the editor to give his 2 cents worth. And so there was a lot of concern and an effort to kind of pull other Christians and get their opinions to kind of find a consensus here. And you do find it in a few cases in individual letters, one minister writing to another, questioning whether or not he should enlist and worried about what might happen to his church if he does. And so, it was on the minds, it weighed heavily on the minds of many of these people.
One of the things that you address in the issue of, in chapter 4, you call the chapter Christian Patriotism, and you talk about something known as Summer Thanksgiving. What is the Summer Thanksgiving?
Yeah, so throughout the war, both the United States and the Confederacy would issue proclamations for days of fasting or days of Thanksgiving. And so in the North, one of these days of Thanksgiving took place after the Union victories in Gettysburg and Vicksburg, July 4th. And so Lincoln issued a proclamation of Thanksgiving for August, first week of August, I believe it was August 6th. And so the reference was to, thank God for his blessings. And in this proclamation in particular, it went beyond a lot of those that people might consider, oh, this is just civil religion, this is the president using the language of religion because it appeals to a lot of people. In this proclamation, Lincoln actually referenced the Holy Spirit, which is amazing that you find, very few official public state proclamations that would reference the third member of the Trinity. And people picked up on that because these proclamations would be printed in newspapers, and they could read them. And there were people saying, well, if we're going to reference the Holy Spirit, then you know, the next step is to mention Jesus in the Constitution, make an amendment, and really, you know, give our country to God, as it were. And so then people would have, on these fast days and Thanksgiving days, they would have special services, and there would typically be a special message related to the war. Typically these passages might, you know, take some story in the Old Testament referring to Israel in battle and God blessing and giving victory, and there would be a reference that would be a branching off point, and then they would draw connections to the present war. And a lot of these sermons, because they were especially good for the war, would then be printed privately or by the church. They would raise money to have the sermon be printed. And so there would be a wide circulation of these sermons. You know, before there was the internet and professional sports and things like that, you know, politics was what people did for fun. And so they would, you know, read a lot of these political sermons, and they had a pretty wide circulation throughout the North. And the same thing happened in the South.
Do you see as the war goes on, is there a greater fusion between religion and patriotism? I mean, you mentioned there's civil religion, which is kind of a, you know, wishy-washy blending of providence with manifest destiny type of thing. But does this really intensify at any part of the war process?
I argue that it does. I mean, obviously there's a blending of religion and politics throughout American history in a war. You can study the American Revolution, and you can even look in the War of 1812 and the Mexican-American War. There's been studies done, the rise of kind of religion and politics mixing in the late 1850s because of Bleeding Kansas and John Brown and stuff like that. But I think it really picks up during the Civil War because so many people saw this as a providentially ordered war. And if, you know, God is working through the war, then he obviously has meaning for the country. He's using the country. And so, I mean, I really think that religion and politics became closely wedded together during the Civil War. And you can see that not just in these proclamations and in sermons, but in the letters of the civilians. I mean, it's throughout the documentary sources that still exist, showing this mixture of religion and politics.
Now, in terms of fusing religion and patriotism, I know people can really get lathered up in terms of we need to fight this war for God's glory, etc. But when it comes down to the individual, even if you have that God-given patriotism feeling, it's still pretty difficult sending off a loved one to battle. I mean, there's a difference between our country going to war and my son or my husband or my brother or sister heading off to war. And parents have to send their sons to war. Wives have to say goodbye to their husbands, never knowing if they're going to see them again. And you write two chapters in your book, which really have some deeply personal conflicts here. One dealing with, you know, wives left on the home front, and another one with parents, you know, specifically fatherly advice given on Christian manhood. Tell us about what you found there, because that's where I found the book just absolutely fascinating and chilling up the spine.
Yeah, well, a lot of these women, especially you know, young housewives with young children, their spouse goes off to war, and you know, he's the only breadwinner, and here they are. What do they do? How do they keep their family together? And so many of them, in their letters to their husband, are talking about prayer, Bible reading, wanting to know what passage of the scriptures that their husband is reading, so they can kind of be reading the same passages and kind of feel that bond. They are really kind of relying on the Lord, because they feel like they have nothing else. They've been left alone. And so, I mean, some of these women, they have to take up professions like school teaching. They have to move in with their parents or their in-laws because they can't provide for themselves. And there's just a real struggle. One lady in particular, she's wanting to know how to discipline her children and you know, what she should do. It just doesn't feel like the children are respecting her, and just needing that father figure to have some authority and some leadership. And so there's real struggle, and where do these people turn? Well, they turn to their faith, because they really in-depth believe from the depths of their heart that God would, you know, be able to provide and take care of them. And especially when you can, you know, add all this with the fears that they're never going to see their husband again, you know, this is obviously, you know, something that is just difficult for us to put ourselves in the shoes if we don't have loved ones who, say, are in the military today. They were really struggling. And so it does kind of bring this kind of pathos and the reality of the war, how hard it hit loved ones on the home front, and that they turn to their faith to cope.
And the other chapter, and that I would have expected out of a book about this, you know, people turn to religion to, you know, find solace to deal with, you know, your husband missing and that. But another chapter that I just found really fascinating in your book was one that was called Exhorting You to Be Faithful to God and to Man, Fatherly Counsel and the Path to Christian Manhood. What did you find here? How did you find this in letters and sermons and
well, in the cases where these soldiers were young, you know, 18 to 20, hadn't married yet, didn't have a family, and so to a certain extent, they were still under the authority or the shadow of their father. And it then puts them in a difficult situation where they go off then and they prove their manhood in battle, and they yet still kind of have this, well, Dad, do I have to ask permission to do, you know, especially like college students. There's one really good example of a young man who was in college, and he needed to get his parents' permission, and they didn't want him to enlist. And he just pesters them, and eventually they give in, and he serves a short stint and gets sick, and he gets out, and then he wants to serve again. And there's just all this back and forth. And then, you know, do they, once they're in the Army, you know, their pay, do they send that back to their parents? Do they get to keep that? Or if they're even older and married, you know, they're relying on their father or older brothers who maybe are beyond the age, beyond 45, to help take care of their farms, to help take care of their family. So they're still dependent on another male to help provide for their wife and kids if they are married. And so there's this sense of dependency, and on the other hand, it's stepping out of the shadow of the fathers, and yet you've got these fathers who are holding on to control, trying to make sure that their sons, especially if they're younger, are avoiding the sins of camp, prostitutes, drunkenness, reading their Bibles. If they're still trying to be, you know, Christian men, not just proving their manhood on the battle, but still being good Christian soldiers. And so it's not just, you know, the perception was that, well, especially in the 19th century, religion is kind of the area that women are concerned with. They're the ones that are controlling the morals of men. And I do talk about that in the chapter on especially mothers and wives giving advice to their sons or their husbands, making sure they're praying and reading their Bible and doing things that are religious in the Army. But you also see that with fathers, and that's something that historians have missed on, because they don't see fathers and males as being dominant. Because if you look at, say, church membership patterns in the 19th century, the majority, I think it's something like 5 out of every 7 members in the 1850s, when we have good data, were women. And so they look at this as very effeminized religion in the 19th century. But what I try to show in this chapter is that there are a lot of men who care that their sons are being Christians in the Army as well.
Yeah, that's a typical trend. Getting those young men to Sunday beating is kind of difficult. So there is this call to manhood to, you know, be faithful while you are still away, and, you know, understand your manhood through the lens of Christianity or religion. But one of the brutal realities of war is that many husbands, many sons do not return from the front. And the U.S. Civil War was an especially brutal war with an enormous amount of death and suffering. And many people consider it to be a pivotal moment in the history of war. Again, we mentioned that, well, we thought it was going to be a short war, there'd be a few battles, and, you know, I'd play by the rules of the Duke of Queensberry or something, and you throw down your weapons and it's all good. But this lasts a long time, and you're also starting to get photographic images, and the upscaling of the weaponry is just becomes an enormously brutal war. How did people use their faith and Christianity to deal with the death and suffering that this war wrought?
Well, obviously, if you are a firm believer in scriptures and that Christians will go to heaven if they put their faith in Christ, there was at least this hope that they would meet their loved ones in the next world. And so many letters you find, if we never meet again on earth, I trust we will meet in heaven. You know, that's how a lot of these people will close their letters. And so there was a real emphasis on preparation for the next world, understanding that, yes, they may be separated on earth, but if they are truly believers, they will see each other again, and so, you know, this isn't a permanent separation. And so heaven is a theme that goes, especially when you mention all the death and all the dying, and, you know, people like Gary Lederman have looked at how practices of burial and embalming changed death, how now people are dying far away on the battlefield or not having their loved ones next to them to observe their last words. You've got people like Drew Faust looking at how the national government has to, you know, have these national cemeteries and expands their powers just taking care of these soldiers. And so it is changing the whole practice of mourning and death, but yet for the religious people, they can focus on the reunion that they're expecting to have with their loved ones in heaven.
I'm glad you mentioned Gary Lederman, because this allows me to give a plug for a forthcoming podcast that we'll be having on changing images of death in America throughout the 19th and 20th century. So stay tuned for that. But the title of the chapter that you deal with the issue of death and how people dealt with it through a religious lens has a really beautiful title, actually. You provide this quote, "Earth has no sorrow that heaven cannot cure." And you can imagine at the time that people are really struggling with existential questions of life and of death. And there's that old saying that there are no atheists in foxholes. Through your examination of these different letters, you know, sermons and writings, people dealing with death, do you see an intensification of religion at this time?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, in some cases, yeah, these are people who are already religious, but in other cases, yeah, these soldiers, especially they're away from home, and they're, especially in the wintertime when they're sitting in camp and they're bored, and in some cases they might have religious tracts that they can read that will talk about preparation for the next world, and you've got all these, you know, conversions, especially the Southern Army is more famous for its conversions in Lee's Army of Northern Virginia and revivals that are going on. But you see chaplains that are writing back about soldiers who are coming to faith, and even in private letters, you know, there'll be soldiers that'll write to their spouses and talk about going to religious meetings that the chaplain is holding, or going to a church service and being converted and starting to read their Bible and pray. So there's definitely, I think, an increase among some. You know, this can get blown out of proportion. I think the majority of men in the Army are not believers, they're not religious men. Armies are not a good place for morality and faith usually. But there are numbers that do turn to religion because, again, you know, they know that they may never get home again, and so they got to think about what happens after this life. And so there is definitely an increase in some regards, you know, not a large percentage, but you can find a definite presence of an increase of religion because of this fear of death, really.
Yeah. Well. So let's move on in the war, and we've had 4 years of contentious battle here. The war is winding down, and in the process, there's another contentious national election under some obviously very difficult conditions. Hard to have national elections when the war has divided your nation. But the North is nearing victory. We start to understand this, and one could imagine that those who have lost loved ones or who saw the South as being sinful and obstinate on the issue of slavery or of dragging us into this war, you could maybe sense some little bit of vengeance here. I mean, you got Sherman's March to the Sea. That seems to be the spirit of payback for, you know, leaving the Union. How do people deal with this using their faith? Is there, Christian forgiveness coming to the fore now as the war is winding down, or is this, let's bring the wrath of God on these sinners?
Yeah, it's more of the latter, you know, especially what I found as the Sherman's army is marching through Georgia and South Carolina. You've got a lot of these, even housewives, who are saying, you know, hey, this is great, this is retribution for their sin, for starting the war, let's punish them. And then even more so, a desire to punish those copperheads, you know, those anti-war northerners on the home front, and saying, hey, when you guys get done licking the South Carolinians, come back home and you got some people here that you need to take care of. And soldiers in some cases passing resolutions before the election and, you know, saying you shouldn't be voting for these, you know, Democrats, and you should be voting for Lincoln, and you should be, you know, supporting us by your vote and supporting the war. And so there is a lot more of this sense of retribution than there is the sense of, you know, loving your enemies and forgiving those who have wronged you. And so it's interesting that I think, and you can kind of understand why that might be so, especially when you've been separated from your loved one for 3 or 4 years now, and you're wanting this war to get over, and so it's hard, you know, to love your enemies when you really just want this war to end, and you want those people to be punished, not in eternity, but you want them to be punished now. You want them to earn what they justly deserve for causing the division of the country. And so there's, I think, a tendency among some believers to let's have punishment both in this world and the next for some of these secessionists and some of these copperheads in the North.
So the war finally finishes. And for those of you who might not have read about the Civil War, here's a little spoiler. The North does win. But what happens shortly afterwards really has an effect on the national consciousness, and which reverberates all the way down till today, and that is the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And even reading, you know, books about Lincoln's life today, one gets the sense that Lincoln's life and death played out almost as a part of the divine will. He has this majestic sense of destiny as well as tragedy about him, and which was why he looms so large, I think, in our history. How is his death viewed at that time?
It was obviously a shock to most people. You know, they're rejoicing. You know, the war has more or less ended. Lee has surrendered. And, you know, just within a few days here, there's this news that the president has been assassinated, and some people are in denial, and, you know, news isn't all that accurate, and so they have to wait for confirmation. But it shocks people, and, you know, he died, or he was shot on Good Friday, and so Easter Sunday, you know, here's this perfect correlation between Christ providing redemption for those who would trust in him, and now Lincoln, the martyr who has redeemed the country, redeemed, kept the nation together, purged the nation from slavery, and so he's this Christ-like figure. And so you've got a lot of ministers on Easter Sunday, 1865, they're, you know, very quickly changing their message, and they're giving some ode to Lincoln and commendation of all he's done, and they're, you know, trying to figure out why has God allowed this to happen. Obviously, they believe that God is sovereign, and so they got to come up with reasons. And so it's amazing some of the things that some of these ministers say. You know, they'll say, well, you know, Lincoln, because of his second inaugural, he talked about with malice toward none, with charity for all, he was going to forgive the Southerners, he was going to bring them back into the nation quickly. And now Andrew Johnson, he's, you know, a Southerner himself, and he knows what it's like to be with these secessionists, and he's going to be firm and have this kind of harsh punishment on these traitors, and the exact opposite happens. Johnson ends up pardoning, you know, many of the leading Confederates shortly into the summer of 1865. But there's all these Northerners trying to figure out what Lincoln's death meant and what God was intending. So they're still trying to kind of divine that hand on the wall, the handwriting on the wall, what is really at stake here. And they weren't shy about trying to say, well, Lincoln had served his purpose. You know, he was Moses, and he can't enter the Promised Land, and now Joshua, Andrew Johnson, is coming onto the stage. And, you know, it's unfortunate that Lincoln died in a theater. I think he was a Christian. I don't know for sure. Some people even saying that he was a Christian and finding stories where he said that he believed in Jesus. And so all kinds of just different rumors and things that, you know, people trying to kind of the apotheosis of Abraham Lincoln. It took place very quickly in the days and weeks after his assassination.
That's interesting. I mean, we debate that nowadays, and that's an academic debate, how religious really was Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, and Abraham Lincoln, and we try to divine their various writings. You had mentioned that, you know, during his second inaugural, during one of the proclamation for the Thanksgiving, he talks about the Holy Spirit. That seems to be a big indicator, but, you know, politicians say that kind of stuff. Was there this sense of questioning of, you know, was this guy really religious? Or people say, yeah, this guy was really the spearhead of Christianity in the nation.
Well, I think we can definitely establish the fact that Lincoln grew in his personal faith throughout the Civil War. So especially in his early life, his days in Springfield, you know, he wrote some 1840s, a famous piece where when he was campaigning against Peter Cartwright, the Methodist evangelist and preacher, where he, you know, distanced himself from kind of historic Christianity, and then he becomes more of what might be considered a deist. But by the Civil War, I think he really believes in a personal God, and that God is sovereign, that he is controlling events. He doesn't personally talk a lot about Jesus. There's no emphasis that he had, you know, what would be a typical conversion experience or anything. He attended the Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C., wasn't a member, but he attended. So I think he thought, you know, there's all kinds of anecdotes about him reading his Bible, praying a lot. So he was definitely a religious and spiritual man, but I don't think he was, you know, kind of an Orthodox Christian as 19th century standards go. But that being said, he still, I think, had the humility that a lot of Christians didn't have, where, you know, when you look at that second inaugural address and he talks about how both sides, North and South, prayed to the same God, but neither had their prayers fully answered, and yet in all of this, we are going to see the justice of God. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether, is what he says. And so he's got this sense that God's will wasn't what either side really wanted. And so while all these ministers and religious civilians were saying, God is on our side, this is what the war means, Lincoln has this understanding of the more kind of inscrutable nature of providence, that when we're talking about national events, we don't really know what God intends. And I think he had an insight that has allowed some scholars, like Mark Knoll, have called him the greatest theologian of the Civil War, simply because he had this distance between being able to interpret what God was doing and having basically a humility in realizing that, you know, humans, we don't know what God is really up to. We, unless it's been revealed to us, we don't know. And so we should be careful as to, you know, how firm we are saying this is what this means. And I think that's a theme that kind of resonates throughout American history. You know, I mean, probably you recall after 9/11, some prominent ministers who would talk about, well, this is what 9/11 means, this is what God is doing. But yet, you know, Lincoln had that humility that we don't really know what God is doing in national events. We can believe in God being sovereign, but we can't always give the reason for why something is taking place.
Yeah, speaking of 9/11, we do have another podcast where we talked about sermons after tragedies, going back to Pearl Harbor and then through several others up to 9/11. So we'll point people back to that one as well. It does resonate very well with this because it was a look at everyday people or everyday pastors and how they viewed things. I want to close up here with a question that I always ask my authors, especially those who are historians. Your book was obviously a look at this historical moment, very important historical moment, and it reveals a great part of the story that we heretofore never really saw, the thinking of the common folk, how religion helped to shape their image of stuff. And that's wonderful for historical understanding, but history is not just about then, the past, but it really tells us something about the now or our present condition today. In the process of researching this book and writing the book, did you have any significant takeaways that helped you make greater sense of the contemporary world, or did you learn something more about the human condition more generally?
Well, I think I definitely kind of picked up on the potential perils of politicization of religion, and I think that's, you know, so much today. You know, where especially a lot of people look at, well, if you're religious, you're probably Republican, and if you're not religious, you probably vote Democrat, and you've got the two parties kind of, you know, pegged. And look at all the political candidates today who have to say where they fall in on the political, on the religious spectrum, and give their views. And you know, just the whole culture wars and the rise of the religious right. I think there is a sense in some ways that people could look at back at the Civil War and see some of the perils of politicizing religion and talking about politics and, you know, making these grand statements about what God is doing in America today. And they could step back and say, well, you know, is this really the mission of the church? Are we here to change the culture, or are we here to give the gospel and to get people ready for the next world? And so I think there's a sense that some people in the Civil War missed that, and that could apply to religion today as well. So that's one big thing. And just the other kind of what I already spoke about, the humility of Lincoln, I think studying the past does, or it should, bring humility to how you look at the present in your own situation, that, you know, we don't have all the answers, and there's, you know, the human condition is the same. There are still, you know, people who suffer, who lose loved ones, and by looking at the past, we can, I think, gain some insights into how to deal with some of those same human conditions that are still with us today.
Well, that is a perspective that I definitely share on both of your points. And so I want to thank my guest today, Sean Scott. Sean, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.